May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I remember very vividly how I learned it's possible to have too much of a good thing. When I was a little boy, my parents once took me to a pancake house. You know, IHOP or someplace like that, where you could order a stack of pancakes any way that you liked. My taste in pancakes had been pretty pedestrian up until this point. You know, my mother might have served pancakes with butter and maple syrup, and if it was a special occasion, we might have some blueberries on hand. But at this restaurant, I could have any kind of pancakes I wanted, with any kind of syrup on top and with any kind of special toppings. And since it was such a special occasion, I wanted to assemble the most decadent pancakes possible. So I ordered the chocolate pancakes. Oh! And you know, maple syrup doesn't go with chocolate pancakes. You have to put chocolate syrup on chocolate pancakes. And even as a little boy, I knew that blueberries would be out of place on chocolate pancakes with chocolate syrup. The only appropriate topping for chocolate pancakes with chocolate syrup is chocolate chips. And so, in spite of the advice of my mother, I placed my order and I was thrilled to receive a brown mound of fudgy, sludgy pancakes. And as I dug into my plate, I discovered, to my great disappointment, that I only really wanted a few bites. But because I defied the protests of my parents, I felt like I had to keep going. And so I ate as much as I could, and it made me so sick to my stomach. Maybe you can remember when you learned what it meant to have too much of a good thing. And that's how we might consider the earthy image that Jesus offers in his Sermon on the Mount. Not concerning sugary chocolate pancakes, but salt. You are salt of the earth, Jesus says. But if salt has lost its taste, how could its saltiness be restored? When I first got serious about cooking my own food in the kitchen, I learned that a little bit of salt could go a long way. Especially when you add just the right amount of salt early in the preparation of a dish, the salt really brings the flavor together and matures the dish that you are making. With a little bit of salt, a dish tastes not like salt, but more of itself. Salt makes a carrot taste more like a carrot, and a beet taste more like a beet. Salt makes soup taste like better soup. It doesn't add to the flavor of a food so much as it draws that flavor out. So I've always thought of salt as a very humble seasoning, you know? Pepper has its own taste. Chili powder adds something new and different. But salt supports all of the others. Of course, it's dangerous to have too much of even such a modest and humble and gentle ingredient. Too much salt would ruin the dish. It's also possible to use this good thing in the wrong ways. Like you don't add salt to a cup of coffee. Well, last week we heard the words of the prophet Micah. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with God? Micah's summary of God's law is set in the midst of his aggressive critique of three classes of people. Micah had addressed the cruelty of the king's government. He had addressed the pretentiousness of the priests in the temple. And he had even turned his sharp words against the other prophets who worked alongside him. Their efforts were insincere, Micah said. They spoke of truths unknowable to them. They sold their oracles to the highest bidders. So when Micah tells his listeners to do justice and to walk humbly, he means for them to get back to the original purpose of their calling. He means for the king to govern in the interests of the people. He means for the priests to remember their place before God. He means for the prophets to return their focus back to truth and righteousness. And if all these people would invest their energy in these things, Micah says, those who hold political power, those who hold religious authority, and those who advocate for justice in the public square, well, if all of these people would be focused on the right things, then we would see God's will flourish among the people. That's Micah. And Isaiah takes a very similar approach to the prophetic tradition. He's focused on the inconsistencies and the hypocrisies in the life of his nation. And he notes how the public life of Israel and Judah is so defined by public religious practice that is not expressed in daily action and decision making. He points to all the pious speeches made in public. He points to the leaders who make a big show of going to the temple that they might be seen there. He points to the prayer breakfasts and the big banquets. The best example of this shallow religiosity in Isaiah's time was actually those who made a public spectacle of their fasting. Civic and faith leaders who walk around, you know, just looking famished and proudly touting all that they've foregone and all that they have sacrificed to grow closer to God and the people. And still, despite how close they claim to be to God, Isaiah says, nevertheless, they oppress their workers. Nevertheless, Isaiah says, they advance their own interests rather than the public interest. Day after day, they seek the will of God, Isaiah writes with irony, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness, and as if they did not forsake the ordinance of God. As if, he repeats. Isaiah was particularly annoyed by this kind of theatrical fasting. He dedicates a lot of lines to it in chapter 58. How could you fast like that and still quarrel needlessly with one another? Don't you get tired and hungry when you don't eat? People who are really fasting don't appear to be having so much fun. And Jesus will make the same point later in a different way. When you say your prayers, he says, you don't have to say them in public for everyone to see. Say your prayers in private, that they might be a personal devotion between you and God. And when you fast, don't make a spectacle of yourself. God won't hear you more clearly if other people have seen you fasting. That kind of fasting is all for show. So Jesus concludes in the tradition of Isaiah that the public piety is perhaps giving us too much of a good thing. It's religious practice for the wrong purpose. All too rare is public religious practice that also bears fruit in our daily action. Our religious practice is to God as salt is to food. To love God with our whole hearts is to be as humble and pure and earthy as salt. Our worship and our fasting and our prayers, we do not do these things for their own sake. We do them in order to draw out the holiness that is already in us, for God has created us in God's image. We do these things to point to the grace of God. Speaking publicly about faith, fasting in the company of others, these are things that should make us more modest, more conscious of the needs of our neighbors, more lovingly inclined to the will of God. And yet you people are boasting in your religious practice, Isaiah says. Your religious practice is so corrupt it's not even good anymore. If salt has lost its taste, how can saltiness be restored? Answer, it can't be. Throw it out and trample it underfoot, Jesus says. It's not good for anything. How about you choose a different sort of fast, Isaiah suggests, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free. Let's see more fasting with sincerity, he pleads, not for one's own benefit, not just as an exercise in personal purification, not merely so that you might look more righteous or sound more pious. Is not true devotion to share your bread with the hungry, to bring the homeless poor into your house, to cover the naked when you see them exposed? That's real fasting, Isaiah says. That's the kind of fasting that's pleasing to God, whether other people see it or not. Real fasting is public speech about one's personal faith delivered through quivering lips. Choices that align one's inner faith with outer action. Maybe you noticed in the reading that Isaiah 58 is the chapter from which Dr. William Barber's organization takes its name. Then you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. And if you think about it, this image that Isaiah lifts up, what it means to be a repairer of the breach, has in the context of chapter 58 a double meaning. There's the more obvious meaning associated with social justice. To repair the breach is to mend the fabric in our common life by caring for the poor and the oppressed. It's to tend to the social fabric by treating one another humanely and by breaking the bonds of oppression. But there's a second meaning here that has to do with our spiritual lives. Is there not also a breach between our inner life and our outer life, Isaiah is asking? Between our private self and our public self? Our actions do not always match up with what we say we believe to be true. And in that case, our fasting is merely theatrical. Our piety is just shallow signaling to one another. External appearances that are out of alignment with internal realities. These are our hypocrisies and our insincerities. Isaiah says, let's repair that breach too. Let there be consistency between the inner and the outer. Consistency between what we say and what we do. Consistency between our belief and our practice. Consistency between the spiritual and the political. We have to repair that breach in us if we want to repair those breaches in the world. Tending to our lives that they might be led with integrity and righteousness is necessary for us to restore integrity and righteousness in the world. So let's use these good things in proper portions and for their right purposes, that prayer might not advance our own interests, but point us to the grace of God. That speaking of faith might not make us look good in public, but truly express the convictions of our hearts. that we may be not self-satisfied with our good deeds, but drawn closer to the needs of others, that our faith might be pure, that our hearts might be humble, that our love might be honest. That is salt for the earth. It makes more of what's already there. That kind of salt makes faith more faithful. It makes grace more gracious. It makes love more lovely. That is salt for the earth. And we can be that for one another. Thanks be to God. Amen.